Hi, everyone. Radio. Everyone, welcome to The Whole Scoop. This is the Health and Wellness Radio Show, where our guests are always highly credentialed in their... And the goal of this program is to present different and sometimes opposite perspectives to allow the listeners to make informed decisions about what might be the right health approach for them. I am your host, Carol Ferraci, a registered licensed dietitian who's practiced for over 30 years and founder of Naturally Nutrition. You can find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. As a healthcare practitioner, it's important for me to provide highly qualified guests on a variety of topics in order to promote your own health and wellness. Tonight's show is diabetes. What do carbohydrates have to do with it? Please let me remind you that while our guests are highly credentialed on the topics of discussion, it's always recommended to seek medical advice prior to implementing any and all interventions discussed on this program. Call-in number is 347-855-8894. You can also direct questions and comments to www.talkradio.com/thewholescoop. Remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Blog Talk Radio. Again, the call-in number is 347-855-8894. We will have questions later in the show, and at that time I'll be calling out the last four digits of your telephone number. If you are calling in with a question, please remember to press 1 in order to become part of the queue for questions. I'm excited to tell you about who we have on the show tonight. We have Franziska Spritzler, who is a registered dietitian, certified diabetes educator, and author of The Low-Carb Dietitian's Guide to Health and Beauty, who favors a carbohydrate-restricted whole foods approach to managing diabetes and insulin resistance. She works in private practice in Huntington Beach, California, and has been following a low-carb lifestyle since early 2011. Franziska is also a freelance writer whose articles have been published online and in diabetes journals and magazines, including Walgreens Diabetes and You magazine and Costco's Healthy Living with Diabetes magazine. You will find her at www.lowcarbdietitian.com. Joining her tonight is Lily Nichols. She's also a registered dietitian, nutritionist, certified diabetes educator, certified LEAP therapist, certified Pilates instructor, whose approach to nutrition embraces real food, integrative medicine, and mindfulness. She's a regular speaker at medical conferences on gestational diabetes, prenatal nutrition, and exercise for pregnancy. You can learn more about Lily by visiting her popular blog at www.pilatesnutritionist.com and get her book, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes, at www.realfoodforgd.com. So let's bring them on and say hello to Franziska and Lily with us.
Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
Hi,
hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good.
Hi,
hey,
Carol.
Thank you so much. Hi, hi. How? Lily, you're in Alaska. How are things in Alaska tonight?
Luckily, it's nice and sunny, so it's a good day up here.
Cool. Very cool. Very nice. So listen, ladies, this topic on diabetes, I don't know that we're going to be able to get absolutely everything tonight, but I wanted to kind of do this because it's one of the topics that I get calls all the time, and frankly, it's not my area of expertise. And when I really started to put things together, I just did a little bit of research. I'm just astounded. The numbers are growing with diabetes. I mean, fast like 29.1 million people, 0.3% of the U.S. population has diabetes. And that's diagnosed at 21 million people. 8.1 million people, or 27.8% of the people with diabetes, are undiagnosed. That's amazing to me. And then the numbers just keep astounding me in that children of 10 to 19 years are the most common rates for type 2 diabetes happen today. I'm sure you know all this, and you're not surprised by this, but I put that out there for ours because I'm sure they're listening for those very reasons, and I wanted to also kind of make a point as to why we're doing this show. Do you have there are different types of diabetes. I think maybe we should talk about just that in general. Let's start there with the types of diabetes, what you guys are seeing, how prevalent you're, how fast it's growing for you, and what you're seeing. Francisca, you want to start?
Sure. So there are two types of diabetes, type 1 and type 2. They used to be called adult onset for type 2 and juvenile diabetes for type 1, but actually you can develop either type at any age. Type 1 is an autoimmune process that destroys the beta cells of the pancreas that produce insulin, and this is often diagnosed in children, and it is growing in children. The incidence is going up, and that type of diabetes really doesn't have anything to do with lifestyle, and yet the numbers are increasing, and we think it may be something in the environment. It's often triggered by a virus. Although it is more common in children, it can also be diagnosed in adults, even people, you know, quite elderly. I think the oldest person ever diagnosed with type 1 diabetes was in their 80s. So this is the type of diabetes where, as I said, the beta cells of the pancreas are destroyed, and you need insulin to survive. So people with type 1 diabetes have to inject insulin regardless of what they eat or how much they exercise or anything else they do. Type 2 diabetes is a different condition. It is the one that was previously called adult onset, and it's often related to lifestyle, but not always. It's usually there's a genetic component to it, so if there's a lot of diabetes type 2 in your family, you're more likely to get it. Children were never diagnosed with this in the past, but as childhood obesity is becoming a larger problem because of the way that we eat and the lack of exercise that we get, we're seeing it diagnosed in children as young as toddlers. But it's often, in the past, only been diagnosed in people of middle age, generally after they've put on weight. And this type of diabetes can be treated with lifestyle measures by, you know, we'll talk about this a lot more, but watching carbohydrate intake, exercising, stress relief, all of those things can help to control it. You do not need to take insulin with this type of diabetes. However, many people with type 2 are taking insulin because their blood sugar levels are out of control, and this is the way that their doctors have chosen to treat them.
Wow. I've got so many follow-up questions to what you said, but I want Lily to jump in here for a minute because, and Lily, you do prenatal and gestational diabetes, and what about those numbers? What are you seeing in terms of the rates of that, and have you seen a correlation to what I've just talked about with these numbers and what Francis just said?
Actually, the rates of gestational diabetes are also going up, and gestational diabetes is defined as a type of diabetes or carbohydrate intolerance or insulin resistance that develops or is first diagnosed during pregnancy. So when we say gestational, we're referring to during pregnancy, and we are seeing those numbers go up, and there's a lot of, you know, questions about why that might be happening, but we do know that, you know, over the past 30 years, our population as a whole has become, you know, a greater proportion of us are overweight or obese, and that's actually the biggest risk factor for developing gestational diabetes, because essentially you start your pregnancy already with some level of insulin resistance, which generally just gets worse due to the natural metabolic changes that happen during pregnancy. So that's one of the big factors. There are a ton of other things that play a role in the development of gestational diabetes. Diet is a big one. The level of exercise done before and during pregnancy is big. Family history, exposure to pollutants, vitamin D levels. There's all these things that play a role. But definitely just as our general health as a whole, like on a statistical level and population level, gets worse and we get more overweight and we pay less attention to our food choices, the rates of this also go up. So the latest estimates are that 18% of pregnant women will develop gestational diabetes, and that's using the most stringent diagnostic standards. It's a challenging condition because unlike type 2 diabetes, the diagnosis differs by the doctor. So the cutoff ranges for a glucose tolerance test or an A1C, those differ doctor to doctor. But if we use the ones that are accepted pretty much in every other country except the United States, the estimates are that 18% will develop it. And just one other point that I want to make about, you know, the increasing rates of diabetes that we're seeing in children is that we're finding now that, you know, what children are exposed to in the womb, what a fetus is exposed to while in utero, can affect their lifetime risk of developing diabetes. So, for example, babies that are exposed to uncontrolled blood sugar levels during pregnancy face a six-fold higher risk of type 2 diabetes by the time they turn 13, which is absolutely insane. So some of these risk factors are actually starting before the children are born, which is, you know, a really sobering fact.
No kidding. I mean, so they really, it's almost like they don't stand a chance that that if they're predisposed, they're going to end up with something, with an area that they've got to be really focused on for the rest of their lives. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, yes and no. So what generally happens is that their pancreas actually undergoes some changes during pregnancy. At a certain point during fetal development, their pancreas will, you know, develop to the level that the baby starts producing its own insulin. So if the mother's blood sugar levels are high and those are getting transferred to the baby, eventually the baby's insulin production is actually going to go up. And their pancreas actually develops to be abnormally large. So, and again, this is uncontrolled gestational diabetes. There's a lot that can be done to prevent any of these things from happening in well-controlled gestational diabetes. But when the blood sugar levels are left unchecked, the baby's pancreas develops abnormally. So that's, they're kind of, yeah, there's some changes that are set up from the very beginning. Of course, we have to always think, you know, just like any sort of genetic risk, our lifestyle plays a huge role in whether or not we're going to develop diabetes or have blood sugar issues, but it is something that, you know, they're going to want to keep in mind during their life, and hopefully their parents, after, you know, getting the news of gestational diabetes, maybe will make some lifestyle changes so their child is raised in a household with good food and, you know, developing habits with, you know, moving their body regularly and stress reduction and all those things that can maybe offset some of the risks. And also breastfeeding helps offset some of the risks if they've been exposed to high blood sugar levels as well. So it's not necessarily fate or destiny, but it's just, you know, stacking another card in the wrong deck, so to speak.
Sure. And one of the things, well, actually a few of the things that I'm hearing from both of you, and I kind of want to hit these highlights because it's important. Whether you're talking about gestational diabetes or you're talking about diabetes in either type 1 or type 2, eating habits, weight management, lifestyle, all very, very important. All of the things that that you guys, you're sort of mentioning but not really mentioning, so I kind of want to take that turn a little bit because, remember, the show is called What Do Carbohydrates Have to Do With It? And both of you, if I remember correctly, in reading your bios, you're talking about whole foods are important and real foods, which, Lily, I kind of want you to explain a little bit later, the real foods versus the non-real foods, and where we are with carbohydrates and how is it that carbohydrates either control or not control. And I know that there's a discrepancy as to when to start controlling carbohydrates, and not necessarily in the gestational stages. So let's just start with that. Let's just talk a little bit about how lifestyle and eating habits and carbohydrates. I mean, let's go with the low carb dietitian over there, Francisca.
Okay, so I think one of the problems is that for a very long time, people have heard fat isn't good for you. If you have any kind of problem, whether it's a heart problem or diabetes or whatever it is, you need to follow a low-fat diet. And a low-fat diet, by definition, is going to be high in carbs because protein intake is about the same regardless of what type of diet you follow. You can't really overdo it on protein or you'll make yourself sick. So having a higher carbohydrate diet and a low-fat, it sounds healthy. However, people who have impaired glucose tolerance, the way that they develop diabetes is their blood sugar rises too high after a meal. Their cells are resistant to the insulin that their pancreas produces. I'm talking about type 2 right now. And that perpetuates a cycle of elevated insulin getting higher and higher as the pancreas produces more and more insulin to try to get the blood sugar into the cell. It's a problem. With the more carbohydrates you're eating, the more likely your blood sugar is to rise after a meal, and your diabetes is likely to progress. A low-carb diet, which very few medical professionals or dietitians are recommending, it basically corrects this overnight. So if somebody follows a low-carbohydrate diet for one day and they're, you know, eating meat and vegetables and other low-carbohydrate foods or slow-digesting carbohydrates, it's going to have a minimal impact on their blood sugar. It's going to require a lot less insulin because the blood sugar is not rising as high. So that helps to preserve the beta cells of the pancreas that are producing insulin. So that keeps the diabetes from progressing. It also helps to control weight. And being overweight and obese, as we said, is a huge risk factor for diabetes. So you get so many benefits by cutting back on carbohydrates. But in order to do that, you have to increase the amount of fat in your diet. And that's seen as heretical in a lot of, medical institutions and from a lot of diabetes experts, including dietitians. So I have seen amazing things happen with my own patients. There's a lot of literature to back this up, that people will reduce their fasting blood sugar from, the 200s down to normal levels just by cutting back on carbohydrates. It doesn't happen in every case. There's a lot of other things that go, a lot of other factors, including how long you've had diabetes and how much it is related to weight. But it's a huge, huge tool in controlling diabetes that a lot of people don't know about. And they're dutifully eating their oatmeal with bananas and skim milk every morning, when that's absolutely the wrong thing that they should be putting into their bodies, especially first thing in the morning where they're the most insulin resistant.
What would you recommend first morning?
I would actually recommend, ideally, I like to have a little bit of vegetables in the morning as well, but truly, if all you have time for is eggs and you don't have time to make vegetables, I would recommend eggs and just eggs, or bacon and eggs even. That's a fine breakfast. Ideally, as I said, have some spinach or something alongside it. But that is going to make very, very little impact on your blood sugar. You're also going to feel satisfied. You're not going to be hungry a few hours later, because all of those carbohydrates that you eat with the oatmeal breakfast that I talked about, they're going to be digested and absorbed very rapidly. And you may be full for a little while, but your blood sugar is going to go up, and then it's going to crash down. And if you have diabetes, your blood sugar is going to go up. It's going to demand a huge dose of insulin to help it bring it down anywhere near, the baseline range. So, having bacon and eggs for breakfast is not a bad thing. It's actually a good way to start your morning if you have diabetes particularly.
Before I get into any of those questions, I just got to take care of a little business here and remind people that you're listening to the Whole Scoop Radio Show on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Carol Ferraci, a licensed registered dietitian, and you can find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. Tonight's show is diabetes. What do carbohydrates have to do with it? We're talking with Franziska Spritzler and Lily Nichols, and you'll find Franziska at www.lowcarbdietitian.com. and Lily at www.pilatesnutritionist.com. And you can also check out get a copy of Lily's book at www.realfood4gd.com. I want to remind people, too, that if you're calling in with questions, to press the number 1 with a question so you get in the queue for a question. We've got a lot of callers on the board tonight, and Not seeing any questions yet, so I think people are just listening right now. But if you feel like you want to ask a question, remember to press the number one. That being said, Francisca, based on what you just said, where does fruit fit into this? You know, I mean, another thing you talk, I mean, you're really, I mean, you hit a lot of good solid points where we've been indoctrinated with a low-fat diet. We've been indoctrinated with eating the oatmeal for breakfast and whatever. But when you're talking about a low-carb control situation for diabetes or for blood sugar levels, you know, that how much of that oatmeal? I mean, because I don't know that are you suggesting that people just make a quick change immediately, or they kind of gradually ease into this? And you know, we also have the whole role of fiber to think about too, because we've been indoctrinated that fiber is best, and then fiber is a carbohydrate. Is you know, where are we with the grams of carbohydrates, and how much should somebody start to think about or have?
Sure. So in terms of fiber, it is a carbohydrate, but fiber has no impact on blood sugar values. So I like for people to get high fiber, nutrient-dense, unprocessed carbohydrates in the form of certain fruits, and that would be berries primarily. Berries have the least amount of sugar and the most amount of fiber. The banana that I know is everybody's favorite go-to breakfast food is the highest in sugar. It has very little water content. It's very concentrated in carbohydrates. A banana has about 30 grams of carbohydrate alone, and most people are not just going to eat a banana as their carb. They're going to have it, as I said, on cereal. And a cup of berries is so high in fiber that you can subtract out some of the fiber and only get about 7 to 10 grams of digestible carbohydrates if you have a cup of berries. So I personally eat berries in the morning myself, half a cup to a cup of berries every morning, and I think that would be fine, too, to add. Fiber is important. But in terms of people doing this, like making a huge change all at once or doing gradually, that should be based on the individual and what they're willing to do and what feels best to them. I know some people who like to go jump right into it from one day to the next. I will say that it's a little more comfortable to make gradual changes. Also, if you're taking any medications for diabetes, you don't want to do this unless you have checked with a professional to find out what kind of diabetes medications, if the type you're taking, can cause a low blood sugar if you suddenly stop eating carbohydrates or cut down. So all of those things need to be looked at. I would recommend truly talking to somebody like Lily or myself, who has expertise in carbohydrate restriction before you start, you know, just going from one day to the next. I do still think that bacon and eggs or bacon, eggs, and some berries and some greens would be a fabulous breakfast. But if you are taking medication or you have other medical conditions or something, you definitely would want to talk to somebody, you know, knowledgeable in that area to kind of guide you and help you meal plan.
Okay, so so it is an individual approach based on all of those factors you just mentioned. Lily, what about, you want to jump in here with the gestational component and or the prenatal even component on what, you know, low carbohydrate isn't necessarily recommended during pregnancy, but at the same time, what about prior to pregnancy and preparing? Do you have an opinion on that?
Yes. Actually, that's the whole reason that I had to write my book, because the conventional guidelines on prenatal nutrition and nutrition for gestational diabetes are kind of contrary to what you would anticipate to help control blood sugar levels well. So it is a controversial topic. The conventional guidelines suggest that women do not eat a low-carbohydrate diet during pregnancy and eat a minimum of 175 grams of carbohydrates, at least during the second and third trimester of pregnancy when your calorie needs are higher. And as far as I know, I'm the first and probably the only dietitian to be publicly going against those guidelines. But having having published my book and put out all the research to support my stance, there's a lot of other dietitians out there who feel similarly, because really these guidelines are based on the Institute of Medicine guidelines for carbohydrate levels. I mean, how they came up with that number. And there's actually no research to support that there's some arbitrary minimum level of carbohydrates. Now, I don't recommend people go ridiculously low carbohydrate during pregnancy just because they think that's best. But when it comes to managing weight gain during pregnancy and when you have blood sugar issues during pregnancy, I've found that the carbohydrate levels need to be matched on an individual basis to their blood sugar control. And this has greatly reduced the number of women who have to go on insulin or blood sugar medication during pregnancy. You simply, you know, if your post-meal blood sugar is high, you look at what you've eaten before, you look at your carbohydrate levels, and you adjust, you know. And sometimes it only takes dropping down maybe 10 grams of carbohydrates from the meal in order to get normal blood sugar after the meal. And to me, that feels preferable to putting somebody on medication when really they don't need it. I mean, when we think about it, you know, if you were to break down the minimum, the conventional minimum amounts of carbohydrates that these women should get, sometimes we're allotting 45 to 60 grams of carbohydrates per meal. And we have to remember one of the ways they diagnose gestational diabetes is with a glucose tolerance test. And some doctors do a two-step one where they give one that's a lower amount of glucose, and then if that's high, they'll have you do a longer test with a higher amount of glucose. And that first screening test is 50 grams of glucose. So if you fail the screening test, meaning you have high blood sugar after the screening test at 50 grams of glucose, why would we expect you to have normal blood sugar eating 45 or 60 grams of carbohydrates? It's just nonsensical. And for the most part, the foods that take the place of some of these high carbohydrate foods are actually more dense in the nutrients that a baby needs for proper development. You know, specific amino acids, fatty acids, vitamins, and minerals, they're more concentrated in your non-starchy vegetables. The antioxidants are more concentrated in your berries. You know, amino acids are highly concentrated in all different, you know, animal foods and meats and eggs and whatnot. So taking out, you know, a small portion of cereal, which is just processed food, often has added sugars and other stuff, in lieu of having eggs, is a really beneficial trade-off for the baby.
Interesting. Thank you for doing all that research and actually coming out and being a pioneer in this, because everything that you just said makes perfect sense. And you're right. What about that GTT, the glucose tolerance test, that is 50 grams of carbohydrate? If you failed that, you're not going to make it when you're eating that for a meal. So that's just basic. I just think that we should continue to make that particular point. That being said, though, we do have a blog question, and it's kind of interesting. I've got a couple of blog questions. I think I'm going to go with this one. You guys okay with taking a question right now?
Sure.
Or is there another point you want to?
Sure.
Okay. My daughter was in ketoacidosis. She was 11. She was very active, and I honestly thought she was tired, and I took her to the doctor. And the doctor said that she was tired and that she was actually more active than she needed to be. So I let her rest, and after a couple of days, we ended up in the ER with ketoacidosis. How was I supposed to recognize that, and how are we supposed to know the difference?
I have a question. So was this daughter, she already had type 1 diabetes and was diagnosed?
No.
That's
a good question.
She was diagnosed in keto, yeah, I'm just curious if the daughter already had type 1 and she was more active than usual and she developed diabetic ketoacidosis, or
just
if she
back
was
in,
more
just
active
back in
than...
No. No, she just blogged back in and said no. This was all new.
Okay, so this is often what happens. This is the way that children are often diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, is that they are they're running high blood sugars for a long period of time, and their insulin production is, you know, getting lower and lower because the beta cells are being destroyed. But if she's, you know, she's very active and she's not aware of the symptoms, if she wasn't losing weight or having any of the other hallmarks of diabetes, but just, you know, more active than usual, then this is often how people are diagnosed. They're in the ER because they, at that point, their blood sugar is so high that it actually makes them ill and puts them into a state of metabolic distress, where they have very, very high acidity. They have no insulin to take care of the sugar, and her sugar is very high. That is what my assumption is this daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in the ER. Is that correct?
She's blogging back in saying, yes, that's correct, but she was upset because she's taken her to, she says, I took her to our doctor, and he essentially just said she was too tired and didn't do anything. So,
yeah, unfortunately,
that to be common too.
You know, really, the doctor, if I'm, you know, again, I'm, I don't know this doctor, but really, if
of course, none of us know the doctor.
Yeah, we don't know this exactly what happened, but I think what happened was, you know, the daughter probably was exercising a lot, and the doctor didn't do a test that definitely would have shown that her blood sugar was elevated had he done the test. You know, I'm sorry he didn't do the test, because diabetic ketoacidosis is very scary. How is she doing now? I hope she's okay. But really, the doctor, in general, when children complain of being tired and they present with symptoms, they should be worked up to rule out anything like diabetes. And she was developing diabetes already. She wasn't in ketoacidosis, but that's how often people are diagnosed. Not always. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's caught on a routine urine test or blood test ahead of time. But this is often what happens. The blood sugar is so high that makes the child ill, and they are taken to the ER or admitted to the hospital.
She's saying she's doing fine now, but very scary, you're right. And she had no idea about any of this prior to this, and this just happened, she says, 2 months ago. And she's saying thank you for confirming what she already thought.
Okay. Well,
so
I wish
thanks
for the
bugging in. Appreciate the question. Please keep the questions coming in. Like I said, obviously we're looking at the blog tonight, and we've got people on the calls. And remember, if to ask a question, to press the number 1. And just to go over the business again, just to remind everybody, if you just tuned in, we are, you're listening to the Whole Scoop Radio on Blog Talk Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Ferraci, and you can find me at www.naturallynutritioninc.com. Tonight's show is Diabetes, What Do Carbohydrates Have to Do With It? We're talking with Francisca Spur and Lily Nichols, who are experts on diabetes and gestational diabetes and low carbohydrates. You can find them at Francisca at www.lowcarbdietitian.com, Lily at www.pilatesnutritionist.com, and Lily's book that you can access at www.realfoodforgd.com. You know what, ladies, that whole thing with the ketoacidosis and getting to that point, I think I chose that question because for me it kind of goes full circle with, if you get to a point of ketoacidosis and you're having to deal with something that severe, you know, what we started to talk about and what we just touched on was lifestyle and the types of foods that you're eating and the carbohydrate control. I don't think that those things have to be specific to controlling just diabetes. That's just a lifestyle choice that actually helps to regulate the metabolic processes. Would you agree with that? And if so, maybe we can talk about, we did mention insulin resistance. We probably need to talk about what that really means, because it's kind of a precursor to all of this, and then let people understand that what you do every day and what foods you take in every day do have an impact on what is to come. Would you agree, Francisca?
Absolutely. Insulin resistance is a case where you are producing enough insulin. In many cases, you're producing more than enough insulin, but your cells are resistant to that insulin. And many people have insulin resistance and don't know it, because sometimes blood sugar levels are okay. You're pumping out enough insulin to take care of the blood sugar so that when you go to the doctor, they're usually not testing insulin, and that's what they should be doing. Really, doctors should be testing fasting insulin in all of their patients, because that would be, you would be immediately diagnosed with insulin resistance or hyperinsulinemia. But a lot of people, they don't, or, their blood sugar may be just a little bit elevated, but it's taking so much insulin to keep that blood sugar even at the 100, which is what we consider kind of the cutoff for, starting pre-diabetes, is about 100 to 125. Fasting blood sugar. But carbohydrate restriction is helpful for people with insulin resistance because, again, you're feeding, you're taking in so few carbohydrates that you're not getting that increase in blood sugar, and that allows the insulin levels to come down because they don't have to constantly be trying to drive the blood sugar down and into the cells. It's also helpful, though, for people with type 1 diabetes to cut back on carbohydrate, because the lowest amount of insulin that you can take, it's going to have a much, much more predictable effect. So if you're trying, people with type 1 have to actually be very careful with the amount of carbohydrates that they eat, because they need to dose the insulin based on the amount of carbohydrates. The problem is, it's really difficult to estimate accurately exactly how many carbohydrates a meal has. Also, the insulin that you inject, the absorption is not always 100%. In fact, it almost never is. You don't know exactly how much is going to be absorbed. You don't know exactly when it's going to start working. And if you're having a meal of just, let's say, steak and broccoli, and you estimate or you count the carbs as being 7 grams, but it's really 10 grams, that's not much of a difference. If you take the insulin to cover 7 grams, you're not going to see much of a difference in the blood sugar. However, if you are having, let's say, spaghetti carbonara or something like that with a lot of pasta, and you think that you're getting 70 grams of carbohydrate, which is, I think, a lot, but you're actually getting 90 or 95, and you take enough insulin to cover 70 grams of carbs, first of all, you're taking in a lot of insulin, but it's still not going to be enough to cover that because you haven't accurately estimated it. So for people with type 1, having to take very small amounts of insulin, because we know that lots of insulin over time, having injecting a lot of insulin or having your own levels of insulin at a high level, that can lead to heart disease risk. It can actually increase your risk for cancer. So keeping the insulin levels low, preventing insulin resistance, by keeping your carbs low and keeping blood sugar and insulin levels stable, that should be a goal for everyone because nobody really knows what's going on inside. You could have prediabetes. In fact, the stats. You brailed them off before, but I believe there's something like 80 million people who have prediabetes, and many of them have no idea that their insulin levels are elevated and that they have any kind of insulin resistance or anything going on. So carbohydrate restriction is harmful for no one, but beneficial for many. And it's just okay. A whole foods, as long as you're doing it in a whole foods way and balancing your meals, I think it can be healthy for everyone, regardless of whether you have what type of diabetes you have or even if you don't have diabetes.
Okay. Lily, you have anything to add to that?
Well, Francisca and I share very similar philosophies, so I have to say I agree. Eating in a way, just what she mentioned about you know, the example of a person with type 1 diabetes who needs insulin to cover their meals. You simply don't have to micromanage things as much when you're naturally choosing foods that are low carbohydrate. You can still eat, like, pretty ridiculously yummy and nutritious foods. You just don't have to count everything. And when it comes, you know, separate from diabetes, I'll just add, you know, for general wellness people, in terms of maintaining your weight long-term at a healthy level, which becomes incredibly important for women who are trying to conceive or having fertility issues, a lower carbohydrate diet naturally boosts your metabolism. If you don't overstimulate your insulin production, your body doesn't get the signal to store that excess sugar as fat, which is basically what's happening with most cases of weight gain. So they actually looked at how effective a lower carbohydrate diet is, a low glycemic index diet, which is just more complex carbohydrates, or a high carbohydrate, low fat diet. And they've actually found people who eat a low carb diet, when even when all these diets are matched in calorie intake, the people eating the low carbohydrate diet burn about 350 additional calories per day, just basal calorie expenditure. So in terms of, like, weight management, it's a really good idea for, I'd say, the majority of the population to at least become aware of what the primary carbohydrate foods are coming in your diet and make sure that you're not overeating those foods. I don't think everybody needs to go super carbohydrate restricted, and I know Franziska doesn't either. You know, there's going to be sort of a range. But when we look at, you know, where carbohydrates are coming in our diet, they're pretty ubiquitous. I mean, it's kind of everywhere, and it's a lot of these foods we've been told are really, really healthy. So whole grains, beans, all legumes, starchy vegetables, potatoes, corn, peas, sweet potatoes, yams. We have our fruits, and then milk and yogurt from the dairy category. Those all contain carbohydrates. And if you're not really cognizant about sort of planning your meals around having a solid amount of protein, a good amount of fat, non-starchy vegetables, and then depending on your carb tolerance or your weight goals or your blood sugar, whatever, sort of picking and choosing a little bit of carbohydrates to go along with it, again, you don't have to add in like a lot of those foods, but just adding those into your, you know, enjoyment level, that alone is enough for most people to get a handle of their hunger and cravings, get a handle of their insulin levels, and just naturally maintain their weight without super obsessive meal planning or calorie counting or any of this other stuff that kind of, I don't know, to me is usually kind of extraneous.
Right. Well, you know, and I think you mentioned a really good point there where if you're cognizant of the foods that contain carbohydrate and you're cognizant of how much you're actually eating, then just curtailing that changes your lifestyle. So when we talk about changing lifestyle, it doesn't have to be this big thing that where you have to make major changes. I think one of the things that I get in my practice a lot is that people will say, "Oh my God, I can't do that." When in fact, just tweaking what they're doing and educating what they're seeing and what they're actually eating on a very small scale makes big changes. And I think that's what you guys are saying tonight. And with that, I want to hit on a couple of topics, but we're going to go to the board. We got a couple of questions, but I want to come back to sugar-free foods, whole foods, and the definition of pre-diabetes. So if we could just sort of hold those for a minute. But we've got a couple of callers. I want to get a couple of callers in. We're going to go with caller. The last four digits are 8796. 8796, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Sounds like what I've been hearing tonight, it sounds like you would recommend like an Atkins or a South Beach diet. Are you recommending that, or it seems to follow the same guidelines?
Okay, I'll take that.
So Atkins and South Beach are a little different. South Beach is actually, it's actually a lower fat diet. Atkins diet can be many things. I am not recommending the induction phase of the Atkins diet for most people. That's extremely low carbohydrate. It's less than 20 grams of carbohydrate a day. Some people would say 20 grams of total carbohydrate, you know, not even adjusting for fiber. I don't think things need to be that strict. I do know of people who enjoy keeping their carbohydrates that low. I think it's okay to do, but I don't think most people, even if you have diabetes, need to be that strict. I recommend somewhere between 30 to 50 grams for most people who just want to have good blood sugar control, 30 to 50 grams of net carbohydrate of whole foods, though. So I'm not talking, that's the other thing, Atkins, that could encompass, you know, Atkins bars and Atkins shakes. I'm not a fan of those. I'm a fan of whole foods, and the carbohydrates are coming from the vegetables and fruits, mm-hmm. some of the dairy products and nuts that Lily was talking about earlier. So it's sort of like Atkins, but it's also whole foods based. And the amount of carbohydrates is going to vary from individual to individual. I gave a 30 to 50 grams of net carb I would say that would control just about everybody's diabetes, and you could adjust up or down from there based on your preference and also testing your own blood sugar to see how your blood sugar is doing. I also recommend getting, you know, 10 to 15 grams maybe per meal rather than getting all 30 to 50 at one meal, because it's much better for your pancreas to take, you know, a little bit a few times a day than to have it all at one time.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in.
I have another question. Someone who is sure. borderline diabetic, home checking your glucose, what should the number readily be? Like, what should you look for to keep them in control?
Okay, you're saying, I think I heard you say that your husband has pre-diabetes. Is that correct?
Well, he actually was told that he's diabetic, but they haven't put him on insulin or anything. It's basically managing his carbohydrates at this point.
Okay. What the numbers should be, you know, really, if he's not on medication, the lowest possible, you know, if he's not taking medication, he's not going to have a dangerous low. But in the morning, ideally, the blood sugar should not be over 100. But if he has prediabetes or diabetes, if he manages it with diet, with keeping carbs really low, he may be able to achieve that. He may need to take an agent like metformin in order to get that. After meals, this is really controversial. How high should it be going? Again, I would prefer not to see it much more than 130 or 140. The American Diabetes Association says 180, but I definitely like to see it below, you know, 140 or less.
So he needs to keep it around 1 to 140?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. Good luck.
Thanks for calling in. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Well, I think given that question, Francisca and Lily, let's just back up a little bit, because she mentioned borderline diabetes. We're talking pre-diabetes. Let's make that a definition at this point so people understand what we're talking about. Who wants to take that?
I'm happy to, but
I'll take it.
So Lily can take it.
I don't know if I remember the exact cutoff, but prediabetes is in some ways kind of an arbitrary definition, because a lot of these are just, you know, what blood sugar cutoff is considered type 2 diabetes or prediabetes is kind of, when do we define the problem? You know what I mean? But for, I think the American Diabetes Association defines prediabetes as having either elevated fasting blood sugar or elevated post-meal blood sugar or both. And so sometimes they'll call it impaired glucose tolerance if it's a high blood sugar that the person's experiencing after meal, but their fasting blood sugars are normal, or they'll call it impaired fasting glucose if they only have high blood sugar in the morning, but their after meal numbers are normal. Essentially, with prediabetes, you're at some of the early stages of insulin resistance. So for a lot of people, this means they have been experiencing spikes in their blood sugar or consistently elevated blood sugar for a period of time. Their pancreas has been overproducing insulin to try to keep their blood sugar at normal levels. And after a while, their cells stop responding normally and become insulin resistant. It's like that annoying neighbor who comes over all the time and knocks on the door, and you're like, are you here again every single day? And you, at a certain point, just don't open the door. Don't let glucose into the cell. And you have high insulin and you have high glucose going on at the same time. It's just quite not high enough to reach the diagnostic threshold for type 2 diabetes. So I believe for fasting blood sugar, if it's over, correct me if I'm wrong, Franziska, because you're probably more familiar with these guidelines, but I believe if it's over 100 or over 110, they'll call it impaired fasting glucose, and then post-meal, if it's above 140, they'll call it, you know, prediabetes or impaired glucose tolerance. Am I correct on that?
Yes, and it's 100. Years ago, it was 110, but they had reduced it to 100.
Okay, it's
so 100. Anything over 100.
Okay. Yeah. So there's different blood sugar thresholds and goals for pregnancy, and since I work so much with pregnancy, my brain tends to mix them all up. But prediabetes is, you're still in the stage where, you know, the beta cells of your pancreas are still producing insulin. It's honestly just a matter of not pushing the boundary so much. And by that, I mean avoiding experiencing very high blood sugar by not eating a lot of carbohydrates, by exercising more, by getting enough sleep, by, you know, stress management, and then you don't irritate the system. Eventually, your blood sugar levels won't be as high. Your insulin production can come down slightly to match your blood sugar levels. Essentially, you can avoid type 2 diabetes if you take those necessary steps early on. You know, it's a reversible condition. And many people are pre-diabetic for years before their blood sugar reaches what would be considered, you know, a diagnostic threshold for type 2 diabetes.
Interesting. We've got another blog question that I kind of want to get in. It says, people with diabetes have increased risk for renal disease, and a high protein fat diet could also aggravate the risk of kidney disease. How do you feel about that's all it actually says. I'm surmising the rest of this. How do you feel about that particular risk factor? Have you seen it? Do you see it often when you're limiting carbohydrates and increasing the protein or the fat? I'm surmising the rest of it. That's pretty much what the question says.
Yeah, actually, high levels of protein, and again, there's a, we're talking how high, how protein. I'm saying, you know, 100 grams or more, depending on how tall you are and how much muscle mass you have. That has never been shown in any trial to impair kidney function. People who have damaged kidneys, and that is due to uncontrolled blood sugar or uncontrolled blood pressure, that's what damages the cells of the kidney. Those people may need to reduce the amount of protein that they have if their kidneys are already damaged. But if you don't have kidney damage, then you can eat larger amounts of protein. And again, I'm not saying, you know, eat 12 ounces of steak at each meal, but a higher protein diet and fat has never been implicated in any kind of kidney damage either. It truly is having uncontrolled blood sugar or uncontrolled blood pressure that causes the kidney problem. So I know that people think high protein damages kidneys, but it's not true. If you have impaired kidneys, then you will need to monitor your protein intake, but not to the degree that that some people would suggest. Really, there are many tests that can be done, a blood test and also a urine test that should be done by people who have diabetes every year. It's a microalbumin creatinine ratio. And people who go on low carbohydrate diets have improvements in these numbers. They don't get worse. So I know it sounds controversial and that, you know, if you have someone taking a lot of protein, it's going to damage their kidneys, but there's just no evidence for that. It's only if you have impaired kidney disease that you would have to watch the protein intake.
Okay, great.
And I'll quickly add to what Franziska said is that when you get the blood sugar under control, the blood pressure tends also to come down. So they're both very closely related. And a high carbohydrate intake, particularly a high fructose intake, has been linked very closely with high blood pressure. So I'll just throw that out there as well.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Appreciate that. I have one other thing I want to touch on, then I'm going to go back to the board for a second. We have a few minutes left. I want to try to get some of this in. Sugar-free foods, good, bad, indifferent. What do you think?
Well,
I mean,
here's an area, a very, very one of very few areas where Lily and I have a tiny little bit of a disagreement. I know she's really not in favor of artificial sweeteners of any kind. I would prefer, you know, a natural type of sweetener. However, you know, based on my reading of the research, there's I think in moderation it's okay to have some sugar-free foods. A lot of people with type 1 diabetes, particularly children, it's you know, to have a normal childhood where they can actually have some really great desserts and treats and things and not feel completely, set off from the other children. And there's some amazing things that can be made with sugar substitutes. So I'm okay with them. I don't like them being used in excess. I think if you're using that much, you know, you really should try to train your palate to want a little bit less sweetness. But I don't really have a problem. That said, in some people, they can trigger cravings for real sugar. And some people, they can cause problems with, they don't tolerate them well, gastrointestinally. If you have any kind of problem, then I would say stay away from them. But I would say in general, I think they're okay in moderation. It's my one non-whole foods thing that I kind of allow into the diet of my clients if they want them.
Wow. Okay. Lily, you have a different opinion?
Yeah, a wee bit different. I mean, when it comes down to, like, really tight blood sugar control and people really don't have the wiggle room for some natural sugars in their world, then I can see a place for artificial sweeteners, but in very, very, very small amounts. And I'd prefer, if you're going to go that route, you know, use stevia, which is the calorie-free and not chemical-derived. I'm specifically, Franziska mentioned the sweet cravings, which some people will experience more cravings for actual sugars when they eat artificial sweeteners. There is some evidence that some artificial sweeteners can stimulate, they don't raise your blood sugar, but because they're, you know, accessing your sweet receptors, it'll trigger an insulin response, which if you're not also taking in some carbohydrates or real sugar that's going to raise your blood sugar, you can kind of drop too low, and then that may drive you to crave more sweets. There is some research on them being somewhat addictive. They've compared saccharin to cocaine in lab rats, and the I think it was 94% of the rats preferred the sweet taste of saccharin to the cocaine. So it does trigger those same mechanisms in the brain. There is some research on sucralose, which is Splenda, on affecting the gut bacteria levels. And we know that our gut bacteria populations play a big role in the way that we partition nutrients and digest our food and our immune health and all those things. So for me, I'd rather people not use them. And if you need a little sweetness, you know, try to get some sweet from smaller amounts of fruit, from maybe some stevia, maybe some of the easier to digest sugar alcohols, I think are fine in small amounts, like xylitol or erythritol are pretty well tolerated. But in general, I think most people are best just weaning themselves off of sweet taste as much as possible, because no matter what, sweet flavors are on some level addictive and do sort of train us to want more and more sweet. So natural or artificial, I think we should be eating less sweeteners in total.
Right. Okay, we are almost out of time, but I'm going to take this one question. This person's been on the line for a long time. 6121. 6121?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
Yep. Hi. You have a question?
Yeah. You know, when y'all are talking about, like, you can have, like, 10 grams of carbohydrate, blah, 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 I start getting very confused. So could someone just run through, like, a day's menu so I can kind of see, like, what that would include? And then also, if you have enough time, could you do, say, a vegetarian version of that?
Yeah, I should get out my book because I have about 2 months. So, yes, if you don't mind, that's exactly what I'm going to do, because in my book I have like a day and I have vegetarian options for each meal. So let's start right here. Like breakfast, a low-carbohydrate raspberry smoothie. So that would be, you know, some raspberries, protein powder if you are using that, or some Greek yogurt and some almond butter. And then coffee or tea with, you know, creamer or half and half. And then lunch, if you're not a vegetarian, canned salmon mixed with half a medium avocado over greens. If you are a vegetarian, you could do the same thing with Greek yogurt instead of the salmon. And then the greens, as I said, with like a vinaigrette of olive oil and vinegar. A cup of blackberries, and then a sugar-free beverage of choice, water, tea, or iced tea if you like. A snack of 15 black or green olives and a slice of cheese if you like. Dinner, a Chinese chicken salad, if you know, made without sugar, made with you know, soy sauce and then the veggies and the chicken and olive oil and sesame oil. If you're vegetarian, you could make a Chinese seitan salad or a tempeh salad using the fermented soy. And then half an ounce of dark chocolate, and then water, tea, or other sugar-free beverage. So that's what it would look like. Vegetables at every meal, except for that morning I had fruit at breakfast, raspberries instead. Vegetables and possibly some fruit at meals, and then and always having a healthy fat source as well.
And do you want to give the name of your book again?
Sure. It's called The Low-Carb Dietitian's Guide to Health and Beauty.
Very cool. That was a nice menu. Very nice.
It was the first one I saw. There's others in there with eggs and all the other things I talked about too, but that's the first one I saw.
Very nice. Caller, do you have another question? Did that answer your question?
No, that's good. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay, great. Thank you for calling in. Let's see. I think we've got maybe one more. You guys have a couple minutes, because we're just over time here. Do you have a couple minutes, and we'll do this last question here?
I can go a few more minutes. How about you, Lily?
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, great. 4977.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello?
Hi.
I have a quick question. Does the quality of our drinking water affect our blood sugar?
Lily.
Wow.
Lily,
gosh.
That one.
That's interesting. I always take all the weird. I would take all the weird off-topic questions. Yeah, I would say I'd be very surprised if it would directly influence your blood sugar. Like, you have a glass of water that's not the best quality water, and then you experience high blood sugar afterwards. However, if there are toxins in the water, over time, those could impair the functioning of your pancreas and your insulin production. Because we have to remember, you know, our pancreas is part of our endocrine system, our hormone system, which is really sensitive to the effects of toxins, like plasticizers or, you know, low levels of medicine residues that can be present in drinking water, like, you know, they've found trace levels of hormones from birth control pills, for example. So, like, you know, if it's not a clean water source, over time those things could be a problem. But I'd be surprised if you noticed, like, you know, you check your blood sugar drink a glass of water and check your blood sugar again, I'd be really surprised if you saw a significant difference in terms of immediate effects, because there's no carbohydrates in water.
You might agree. Actually, okay. I think it would be
long-term. A little bit long-term. Less. If, because you're more hydrated, your blood may be a little slightly thinner. Again, I don't know if a single glass of water would do that, but for some people, when they, you know, if they're well hydrated, they'll register lower blood sugar readings. So that could be a possibility.
Okay.
Wow.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you for calling in. I think I want you guys to let everybody know how they can get a hold of your books, because you have some fabulous information. We could probably even go a little longer, but I don't want to hold you up. So I'm going to ask both of you if you'd like to come back and maybe do a follow-up show to some of this, because I think we could probably pick one or two topics of the things that we've talked about tonight and really, really hone in on all of that and how it relates to the low-carb lifestyle. Would you be willing to do that?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think it'd be great. So please, Lily, tell us how we can get to your book.
Sure. You can find my book at realfoodforgd.com, GD standing for gestational diabetes. I have a free video training series there and also a link to my online course on the topic. You can also look up my book on Amazon. And then if you just want to get in touch with me for, you know, my blog or any of that other stuff, I blog weekly at PilatesNutritionist.com.
Great. Thank you. Francisca, how do we get to your book and you can go ahead and give your contact information again, too, please.
Sure. So my book is The Low-Carb Dietitian's Guide to Health and Beauty. If you put my name into Amazon, it's the only book I've written. So it's shorter to type my name in, although my name is harder to spell than the title of my book. So it's your call. You can type either one into Amazon. You can also access my book through my website. I have that might be the easiest of all. That'll take you to Amazon. My website is www.lowcarbdietitian.com, and I do have a book tab up there, and I also offer diabetes coaching and, you know, anybody who would like to work with me to develop a healthy low-carb lifestyle.
Perfect. That's just wonderful. You guys have been fabulous. I can't thank you enough for being here, and the information that you've given is just amazing, and I'm hoping that we've reached a lot of people. Thank you all for calling in. Thank you all for blogging in and keeping the show always active as you always do. Join us on August 6th, where we're going to be talking about inflammation. We're also going to be talking about IBS and how it's not always in your head. A lot of people are getting diagnosed with IBS, which is something that you hear every day in the physician's office pretty much, and it all has to do with the internal inflammation that everyone's also hearing about, and you don't necessarily know what that means, and some people are being told that it's all in your head. Well, we're going to talk about that, and we're going to kind of explore it. We're going to have a couple of other experts on, and we're going to hit that loud and clear. So thank you again for tuning in to The Whole Scoop. And we look forward to talking with you again in a couple of weeks. Good night, everybody. Thanks so
Good
much.
Good night, Jill.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Thank you.